morning. I'd like you to open your Bibles to Revelation chapter 17. Today we're going to look at 17 and 18. I'm not going to read all of it, I don't think, but we'll be discussing it. Before I begin, though, I would like to remind you, March this month, there's a fifth Sunday, and on the fifth Sunday, we're going to have an extra collection, as we tend to do. And this particular collection will be to help a mission effort. Sunset International Bible Institute is putting together these audio recorders, solar-powered audio recorders that will have a complete audio Bible, Old and New Testaments. It will have a complete set of lessons from their preaching school. It will have a complete set of lessons from the World Bible School, evangelistic lessons and follow-up lessons. And it will also have a collection of songs that the Christians can learn. And the whole idea is to help new Christians in the mission field where they don't have electricity and the people don't know how to read. So in having these solar-powered audio players, missionaries who could only visit maybe once a month could multiply their efforts because they could leave these things behind with responsible people who would be able to share God's word all during those weeks and days that the missionaries are not present. So there's some information on the back on the back bulletin board if you want to find out more. I might be able to find out more for you too if you want to ask, but please plan on sharing in this effort. I think it's going to be a very worthwhile thing. This morning in our passages in Revelation 17 and 18, we're going to talk about a couple of things. I'm going to review a couple of things that we've already said, and then I'd like to add one other and finish with one other thing that's added in this particular section. Well, it's been alluded to before, but it comes up again, that we can act on as a matter of principle. The two things that we've already looked at was, one is the idea that this section of the scriptures is dealing with the upcoming persecution of Christians by the Roman Empire. And up to this point, I pointed to the evidence of the beginning of the book and the end of the book where we're told, get ready, listen up. I'm paraphrasing very roughly, but that's the tone of what's going on at the beginning and end of the book. He who has ears, hear, for the time is near. The time is coming. It's soon. And so we're led to believe that what's going to happen, the things that are shortly coming to pass, we're going to be dealt with in the lifetime of the people who actually received the book. Now, if that part is literal, then we're going to have to look at the Roman Empire and see the fulfillment of it with these persecutions and judgments being fulfilled in the Roman times. Now, the problem, of course, comes because all throughout history, we didn't see all of the oceans turn into dead man's blood. Throughout history, we have yet to see all of the rivers turn into fresh blood. We haven't seen the sores and boils pop out on people who had the mark of the beast. We haven't literally seen any of those kinds of plagues on anybody. And if we have to literally see those things, then we're going to have to wait some more. And we'll have to look at the time frame as being figurative. That soon, when he talks about shortly come to pass in the beginning of the book, that was figurative. On the other hand, we can look at it and say, hey, these plagues and these punishments and these judgments are figurative, meant to give us reassurance about how nasty it's going to be for those that are persecuting our brothers and sisters. It's sort of like, Eliza Doolittle singing about Emery Higgins. If you remember that, My Fair Lady, just you wait, Emery Higgins, just you wait. And she was all mad because she was being mistreated, and she was thinking about all of these delicious forms of vengeance, you know. And it's sort of that kind of thing. God wants us to be assured that justice is going to be served and nobody's getting away with anything, whether it's the bully down the street, the bully in school, or whether it's some government that's persecuting God's people, that he has all of that in hand. And I really appreciate I really appreciate Jared's choice of song in that relationship. It fits. Nobody's getting away with anything, and we're not losing anything, and we need to know that. And so by using these figures, he reassures us on an emotional level that nobody's getting away from anything. And those emperors and those Roman soldiers and the whole business, they're not getting away with murder. It's going to be taken care of. And I'd mentioned before, they're going to be dead. They're going to be deader. They're going to be deader than dead. I mean, what's going to happen? They're going to be piled into a wine press, and enough blood is going to pour out for 2.25 billion people. And then after that, they're going to have sores all over their bodies. Well, wait a minute. I thought they were crushed and all their blood came out. Well, not only that, they're going to have sores all over their bodies. The sun's going to come down and it's going to fry them. And the oceans are going to turn into blood and the rivers are going to turn into blood and they won't have anything to drink. And then there's going to be a huge army to come and there's going to be this great big battle and they're going to lose. And then 100-pound hailstones are going to hit them. And what are we supposed to take out of all of that? Boy, are they going to lose, right? And I think that's really what he's trying to say. And I kind of think we're going to have a long ways to wait if we're going to try to find, you know, be on the lookout for the 100-pound hailstones. Not that God couldn't do it, but it's likely that the way he's describing these punishments are figurative, and the time frame that he implies at the beginning and end of the book are not figurative. And in chapters 17 and 18, there are clues about that. And I'd like to look at that now. And then I'll draw a lesson from the harlot. This 17 and 18 deal with the harlot. John sees the harlot. And a harlot is riding on this beast that looks suspiciously like the beast that comes out of the ocean in chapter 13. She's riding on this beast and... some things are said about the harlot, some things are said about the beast, and some particular details about all of this, again, points to Rome. So we have a little more evidence that points to a Roman interpretation of these passages. And then, of course, chapter 18 talks about her demise. And that also contains evidence that it's talking about Rome, but it also brings in the second point, the idea that God's taking care of all of this. You don't have to worry about it. Let's start to look at chapter 17, starting in verse 1. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of unclean things of her immorality. And on her forehead was a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. When I saw her, I wondered greatly." Let's stop here for a minute. So here we have this harlot that's really decked out, okay? Now, harlots stay in business. They can stay in business because they're dressed up and look good, right? And this is what they're showing this harlot. There's an appeal. There's a seduction about this woman. And I'll get back to this idea toward the end of the sermon, the idea of not being seduced by this world, not being seduced by the powers of this world. This woman was one who did seduce people of her world. This woman was the one, was Babylon the Great, who induced others to participate into her immorality. And this woman was drunk on the blood of the saints, Christians. And she was drunk with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. When I saw her, I wondered greatly. So whatever she is, she has the name of the city, Babylon, which I believe is symbolic of this oppressive conqueror. And she's the one who is killing Christians. Well, who's that? Sounds like Rome to me. If you go all the way down a little bit to verse 9, here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads, that is of the beast, are seven mountains on which the woman sits. What city sits on seven mountains? Rome. For thousands of years, Rome was always known as the city on seven hills. For centuries. And back then. And then down in verse 18, the woman whom you saw is the great city which is reigning or reigns over the kings of the earth. Who was reigning over the kings of the earth at that time? The city that was reigning over all of the kings of the earth at that time. It was Rome. So just with this, it was saying Rome, 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 pointing to Rome. Now, in our class in Daniel, Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7 point to Rome also. Daniel 2 talks about the parts of the statue, and each part represented another kingdom that was going to come up. And you start counting the kingdoms, and at the very end, you end up with the fourth kingdom being Rome. And it's in that kingdom that God sets up his eternal kingdom and destroys the other kingdoms. When did Jesus come? During the time of Rome. When did God's kingdom get set up? During the Roman times. When Jesus came, that was when his kingdom came. We're in his church. We are his kingdom. And his kingdom has continued on. Rome came and went. The Third Reich came and went. Any other kingdom you can count came and went. But Jesus' kingdom continues on. It's God's kingdom came in the time of Rome. And in Daniel 7, there are four beasts. And we talked about this in Bible class too. There are four beasts. Each beast represents a kingdom. What was the fourth beast? It was Rome. And this beast was going to do what? Persecute God's holy ones. Surprise, surprise. What kingdom started killing off Christians? What city became drunk on the blood of God's people? It was Rome. Some other interpretations of and I'm not going to get into details about this, but some other interpretations of the Bible where people would say Revelation is going to happen in the future. They say that because they haven't seen the literal fulfillment of those judgment passages. But they usually include this idea that we're going to have a new Roman kingdom come up. And we're going to have a new temple built. And all of the conditions that originally were there when the book was originally written have to be recreated in order for these punishments to be non-literal, to be literal rather than figurative. So with all of this pointing to Rome being the culprit and the struggle between Christians and Rome being the center of this whole thing, I think that's what it is. And I think you can see it more as you think about it and as you read it. So anyway, that's one thing. We have these sheets. We went over these on Sunday night, last Sunday night. We're using this in the Daniel class also, and there's some extra copies on the desk in the front, so you can look at it more carefully. And I'm going to look at verses well, let's see, verses 8 and following in chapter 17 right now, and it still talks about Rome. Verse 7, we'll go from there. The angel said to me, "Why do you wonder? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss and go to destruction. Those who dwell on the earth, whose name has not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will wonder when they see the beast that he was and is not and will come. Here is the mind of which has wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sits. And there are 7 kings. 5 have fallen, 1 is, the other has yet to come, and when he comes, he must remain a little while. And the beast which was and is not is himself also an 8th, and is 1 of the 7, and he goes to destruction." Let me stop here. This is it. The way it's worded is very tricky, and maybe I can make it a little bit more simple. First of all, God uses the figure of the heads of the beast to represent the hills that the woman sits on, identifying what the city is. And then he said, okay, those 7 heads also represent kings. All right, start counting kings of the Roman Empire. Start counting the emperors. So you go from Augustus to Tiberius to Gaius, who was also called Caligula, Claudius and Nero. 5 were. That means those 5 have come and gone. Then he says, 1 is. Now here's the tricky part. There were 3 guys who were sort of like emperor for the day. I mean, it wasn't exactly a day. It was a big turnover during this time after Nero died, and there were continual, almost continual civil war, and each managed to reign for about a month or two or a few months, and met their demise until Vespasian came along. I believe that these guys are being ignored in the book of Revelation, and the one that he's talking about is Vespasian, the one that is. Because he's the next one that actually obtained power and held on to it. And it also corresponds with the way that Daniel chapter 7 portrayed it. It portrayed it in a different way. It talked about a beast with 10 horns, and then he added an 11th, and 3 were uprooted. Well, in both cases, you end up with 8. And in both cases, the 8th horn, or the 8th king, is the one who does all of this persecution stuff. So it does fit. You'll have to pick through it, read through it. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here. We did it last Sunday night. But what it tells us is the book was written sometime between 69 and 70 AD, that Domitian was this 8th head, and that he was the guy who's going to do all the dirty work, some of the dirty work that Nero began. The persecuting of God's people began with Nero. He was the one who actively persecuted Christians. He was the one who started the business. Up until that point, Christians were not on the radar screen of the Roman Empire in general. There were local persecutions, because there were clashes with idolatry and clashes with local people. But as far as an empire-wide policy, it really, you know, it started a little bit with Nero, and it came with a vengeance with Domitian and afterwards. And so here's this picture. You have a resurrected beast. Well, he was alive in Nero. He wasn't existing at the time that John was writing as a persecuting power. He wasn't existing. Rome was still there, but it wasn't a beast. It wasn't a persecuting beast during the time of Vespasian or Titus. Rome was not persecuting Christians at that time, but what happened? When Vespasian's son and Titus's brother took power, he decided he'd take his godhood seriously. And if you didn't worship me as God, then you weren't faithful, and you're a traitor, and we're going to kill you. And we're going to do it for entertainment. We'll watch you be torn apart. either by soldiers or by lions, or or we'll torture you or do all sorts of fun stuff. I mean, here was a guy who grew up thinking that torturing insects was fun. And so here was the beast, a resurrected beast, and that's how Revelation is portraying it. And what we need to know is that he's going on to destruction. What we need to know is that the city he ruled from is going on to destruction. That he's not getting away with it, no matter how much persecution, no matter how much pressure comes from the governments or other people, they're not getting away with it. And that's our main theme. The secondary theme I talked about here is that it's centered around, the actual book is centered around what's going on in Rome at the time. And so here we go. I want to talk a little bit more about the rest of this passage and then get to our third point, and then we'll conclude. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority with the kings, with the beast, for 1 hour. These have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast. The nature of the Roman Empire was such that they held together by not only conquests, but by alliances. And that made them brittle, but also strong, but also brittle. Just the same way that statue with the clay and the iron were mixed in Daniel chapter 2. There were alliances from different peoples. And they had their kingdoms, but they were all giving their power to whom? To the emperor. And I think that's what he's talking about here. So in verse 14, these will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, because he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And those who are with him are the called, the chosen, and the faithful. There it is, we win. We are the called, the chosen, and the faithful. Those of us who are faithful to God all the way through, we resist the temptations, we resist the persecutions, we remain faithful to him unto death, we receive that crown of life, and we win. That's written all over this book. And it's a principle that keeps applying. It doesn't just apply to the Roman Empire. It applies to every empire. It applies to every person who calls himself king or leader or a high potentate or whatever other name they want to call themselves. We know that our king and our father is over all of them. He is King of Kings. And we are in his kingdom. And it's our job to be faithful to him. And we do that, we have everlasting life. We do that, and we know that he'll take care of all of the mess. He'll take care of all of the pain that we felt. He'll take care of all of the loss that we felt. He'll take care of even losing our own lives. We know he's got that under control. And that's what we need to remember. And that's what chapter 18 is about. This is bemoaning the death of the harlot. The harlot is going. The harlot's going to be gone. There's a couple of pictures here. One is all of the kings of the world in verse 9, chapter 18. The kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensually with her will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment, saying, "Woe, woe, the great city Babylon, the strong city, for in 1 hour your judgment is come." A picture of them being judged. They were powerful, they were all powerful, but now they are nothing. Now, Rome wasn't, you know, destroyed like Sodom and Gomorrah, but you try to find the Roman Empire now. What do you see? A bunch of old buildings, tourist attractions in a modern city that has absolutely nothing to do with Vespasian or Domitian or any of those guys. It's just a mausoleum. We won. The whole world knows that we won. The whole world knows that Christians won that battle. We need to remember that we will keep winning. Now, I mean, that's for us here. We need to remember that we keep winning. if we follow the same pattern that the first century Christians followed. We follow the same encouragement that they were given. And in the whole passage, in I won't read chapter 18, but the bulk of what's going on in chapter 18 is that there's this great big mourning over the loss of the city. And then there's a picture of a great millstone being thrown into the sea. And that's the way the city is going to be. But that's a different kind of a judgment than it being burned up. Is it going to be thrown in the sea, or is it going to be burned up? But in a previous chapter, it was going to be split into three places with a huge earthquake. So which way is it going to be? I get a feeling that it's all figurative. You know, you think about how many ways Eliza Doolittle was going to get her revenge. You know, think about how many ways God is expressing how he's going to avenge us, you see. He wants us just to have that gut understanding. This is how it's going to be. They're going to lose. You know, lose with capital letters and underlined three or four times. That's the idea. And so in verse 20, "Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her." So here it is. We knew she deserved it, and she's going to get it, and we're confident in it. And if we're going through that persecution, we can go with confidence, having God's assurance, and just like we can today. Now, there's something that's also a matter of warning in this, and I'd like to finish with that because it adds to what we've gone through over these past few weeks. And that's the idea of being separate. We talked about that before. We talked about it when Jesus chastised Thyatira and Pergamum about compromise with their teachings and compromising with the world, not to do that. And here we have the same idea expressed in a different way. What was the woman? What was the city? It was Rome, but what was the city doing? It was seducing the world to partake in her immoralities. And what were those? Well, there was, let me count the ways that Rome introduced immorality into the world. I mean, the emperors made the most immoral of our presidents look like innocent Boy Scouts. Really? I don't even want to speak about it in public. It's so disgusting. The personal immorality of these people who claim to be God. But they glorified in ripping out blood and guts of animals and people. They glorified in treating people like objects and treating people like they were worth dirt. Slaves were worth dirt. They glorified in cruelty. They glorified in all sorts of idolatry. And not only that, but they also seduced people to worship their government, to worship their emperor, and to be awestruck by the vast power of the Roman Empire. Everybody wants to be part of something bigger than themselves. Everybody wants to be part of a cause, and a wonderful cause. And here was Rome that put in all of these roads, and here was the Roman peace that brought all of these countries together, and you were able to travel from one end of the world to the other. And here was this might and this power, and people wanted to be part of it. And if you don't look up any higher than the highest political leader for your leadership, what kind of trouble are you going to get into? But that's what people did. That's what people do, isn't it? And isn't that what we have to watch out for? How many people go astray because they fall in love with their preacher and they start looking at their preacher as if he was Jesus? I make mistakes. I follow a long way behind Jesus, and I fall short quite a few ways. Don't look at me as God. What would Jack say? Don't look at me as your surrogate conscience. You need to look to Jesus. You want to look to a leader that you put your hope in? Don't look to our governor. Don't look to our president. Don't look to any worldly leader as the source of your hope or the source of your salvation. Look to Jesus. We can be so easily seduced. I mean, there's so much money in Washington, and there's so much money in the State House, and there's so much power. We can start to think that it's almost godlike, and many people do, and they become so dependent, and they rely so much on the physical things that the powers of this world can give, that all of a sudden, there's a form of idolatry coming into play, even though you don't have statues of these people. Even though you're not putting incense in front of statues of these people, you start serving the created rather than the creator. And we have to watch it. And it doesn't matter who it is. We have to watch it. I think, how did people treat Hitler? Like a god. How did people treat Sun Myung-un? I think I got to pronounce the name right. The guy who's in charge of North Korea. And how did he treat his father? Like he was a god. And that was the kind of thing that the Romans were doing. And then they didn't have... The Romans put up statues and insisted that you worship the statue at least once a year. You had to prove it. Prove that you did if you want to do business. Well, a man has to live, right? And it's just one... It's just one little pitch of incense. All you got to do is say, Caesar's Lord, Lord God, Domitian, and then you're good for a year, and you only have to do it once, and then all the rest of the time, I'll be okay. That was the temptation. You're talking about being seduced? You know, they put their arm around you and pretend you're your best friend, and they start saying, you know, well, all you got to do is this. All you got to is compromise a little bit. The harlot's all gussied up and wants a big kiss. Isn't that the way Satan works? And what happens with us? Our society, sometimes we start to think that, well, that our society tells us what's right and wrong. And if it isn't against the law, and if people are doing it on TV, it must be okay. How right is that? Whew. It isn't. We get our right and sense of right and wrong from God, right? He's the one who calls the shots. He's the one who's supposed to be molding our hearts and molding our minds. And so there's still a seductress out there. She isn't named Rome per se, but Satan's still out there, and she's still trying to seduce us in all sorts of different ways, not just sexually, but also in the way we think. The way we think about people, the way we think about money, the way we think about life, who we're depending on for life. And so we have to be careful about that. And in verse 14 of chapter 18, it says, I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, so that you will not participate in her sins and receive her plagues. For her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. And this is my final warning to everybody here. I'm running a little over, but the warning for today, for this week, for our lives, really. Come out from Babylon. We're living in Babylon, our own kind of Babylon, aren't we? One of the best descriptions I heard of this, Jesus says that we are in the world, but we are not of the world. And one of the best illustrations I've ever heard about this is like, we want the boat to be in the water, but we don't want the water to be in the boat. We are in this world, but we don't want this world in us. We don't want this world to seduce us into its way of thinking and its way of behaving. We have the victory. We hold on to our faithfulness, but we also need to keep the world out of our hearts and out of our minds. And remember who our real king is and where the real power is. And let's go out with that kind of conviction, please, as we encounter the harlot seducing us day by day, minute by minute, in this world of ours. If you have any prayer requests, if you want to put the Lord on in baptism or have any other requests, please come forward as we stand and as we sing.